tell me a little bit about where you were born and what you did, if you went to school in Winnipeg?
I was born here in Winnipeg in Jamison Avenue. I went to quite a few schools, McRae as a visitor. Most of my education and bringing up was in an old boys' home. I was there from 22 to 28. I left there and I went to live with my mother and my stepfather in North Kelowna. I attended Lord Kitchener School. In 28, I joined the militia, Fort Garry Horse. Used to go to summer camp at Stonewall and Selkirk.
Did your friends join at the same time?
No, just myself. Oh, I had one friend in 1929 or 30, a fellow by the name of Tony Benelli. He joined the Fort Garry Horse, too. He was an Italian lad. And of course, we both went to the same school together. I don't know. I guess the uniform attracted him. When I left school, I graduated. I left school in 1932. And as you know, it was the Depression time, so I enlisted with the Lord Strathcona Horse Permanent Regiment, or Cavalry Regiment. I was with them until 1935. I came out and I was employed then by the Winnipeg General Hospital.
Did you have any trouble getting a job at some time?
No, not. The wages were poor, 12 hours a day. You had your laundry done, you had your meals, and you got $47 a month for 12 hours a day. I took a training as a what you call now, in this day and age, a male nurse. I started at the bottom of the ladder. I emptied bed pans and cleaned bottles and changed mess beds. I was moved from there after getting initial training. I did my hitch for 6 months in the post-mortem room and the morgue. On spare time, when you're not too busy down there, you served in the casualty ward, tending to accident victims and so on. I did a hitch in the path lab, urinalysis, blood counts, stool tests.
Wow, you were really growing up in the home.
So then I eventually I ended the last theater. Oh, I did my little turn at maternity, had a few babies born. I ended up in the operating room theaters. I worked under my own namesake, Dr. Murray, Dr. McCharles, Dr. Thorlickson, Dr. Farney, all the whole works. I learned everything from leg amputations to cranotomies, you name it, I went through it. The war broke out, just prior to the war, we knew that it was coming. I tried to enlist with the Royal Flying Corps. I passed all tests, physical, mental, and when I was just about ready to be sworn in front of the wing commander, they found out that I had this medical knowledge background. So, no way. He told me that I'd be, I had more service to give to other units at that time because they were only looking for machine gunners and pilots. I left their office, which was located in the mental barracks, and I went downstairs. And eventually I came across the Grenadiers recruiting office.
This was downstairs?
Yes, on the main floor. And a little short fella by the name of Paddy Keenan, who was the RSM, stopped me in his broad Scotch or English. Old Paddy says, "Yes, lad, and where do you think you're going?" So I said, "I want to enlist." So he had me stand up against the threshold or the door frame. He says, "Stand under that mark." Well, consequently, I was about 4 or 5 inches too short to suit him. They wanted 6'1". So he told me I was too short. So I asked him how in the hell he got in the Army then, although he did have his first campaign ribbons on. So I told him that I was a permanent force man serving in the Loy Strathcona Horse. And right away, I was rushed in and signed on the dotted line, which I think was my biggest mistake. I was made an NCO. We did our training in the field just outside of Mental Armies. And from there, we... this was just actually foot drill, and I always ended up with the two left-footed kikes, you know, that didn't know their right from their left. But anyways, through the whole thing, we eventually got them. We got them from sod busters to pavement busters. On the whole, it was very good. Then we moved to Fort Osborne Barracks, and I was attached to Headquarters Company. I went on a schooling at the YMCA as a physical instructor, got my diploma from them, and I used to get it back at them because I used to get them up early in the morning at Reveille and outside and run them around that city park, even right down from the colonel. And he didn't like that at all. But being in that position, I was the boss at the time.
Did you work too hard?
They did their running and their ups and downs, push-ups, and so on. I met with an accident out in the St. Charles Ranges. We were actually going through our last bit of training. I was on the range. A few of the fellows will remember I was hit in the groin with a machine gun. They rushed me to the general hospital. I was in hospital for about, approximately, 6 weeks. In the meantime, my regiment had left and went to Jamaica. And I was left behind for a period of time. I then was in charge of a... on Portage East, it was what we had at those days, the 30-day wonders, training other chaps. I did this for quite a spell. While these were fellows that were just given basic training and then transferred to other units that would take them, let's put it that way. How much can you train a fellow in 30 days? Eventually, one of the officers came from Jamaica by the name of Major Trist, and he called me in and asked if I would like to go to Jamaica. And at that time, I had 35 grenadiers that were left behind through different things. They were either in the guardhouse, or they were AWL or something, and they were rounded up, and we had 35. We left Winnipeg, and we went to Montreal. We boarded the Lady Rodney, and we sailed down the east coast, right through to, we stopped at the Bahamas, Bermuda, and then eventually to Jamaica. I was in Jamaica until we embarked to come home. I left there on the third draft. Well, the third draft is a fatigue party. You clean up everything and create everything and get make sure it gets back. They billeted us in the Robinson building. And through some unknowing reason, when they were leaving to go to Hong Kong, again, I was unable to pass the medical to be able to go with my battalion. But through a little maneuvering and know-how, I was allowed to, at the last minute, to pack a couple of kit bags and board that train.
Did you know where you were going?
No, not at that time. Because we sort of had a faint idea, at least I imagine everybody else did. We did have our heavy battle dress, heavy underwear, but they also issued us with our khaki equipment as well. And this is a sort of a giveaway. We figured that it was going to be another joyous, luxurious outpost like Jamaica was to some anyways. I believe we were out. Well, we had a little trouble at the docks in Vancouver.
Do you remember any more of the train line?
Not too much. We were not allowed off the train at every stop. With guards posted at each doorway. It wasn't too, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't too exciting. Granted, it was the first time that I had ever been that far west, and I got quite a surprise when I saw the ocean. Because always being a prairie man, I think Lake Winnipeg was about the largest body of water I've seen. Even the boat trip itself, it wasn't too excitement. There wasn't, you weren't allowed to relax too much. Training was maintained on the aft deck and the fore deck, you know, wherever space was available.
You mentioned about the trouble in Vancouver.
The boat. It looked as if it was pretty top heavy. There was a water line there that was like from the naked eye, it was 6-7 feet where it should be below the water, you know. And a few of the lads balked at getting on. They made inquiries. Granted, when we were loading the equipment onto the boat, fellows, you know, were looking around, examining it, and they found that the holes were empty, nothing in them. Rumors spread fast, and next thing you know, there was a sort of a riot, or other words, a strike, whichever which way you, they're both the same. If you strike, you're rioting too. This was brought up to the powers to be, and they pointed some ship off out in the middle of the harbor and said that that was our ship with all the trucks and the ammunition and everything that we were going to require, and that would follow us. Sound reasonable, I guess. Some fellas deserted, but not too many. A few. The majority got on, and they were pacified afterwards in regards to what was going to actually happen. The only one big snag was the men only had one quarter of the ship, and the officers had three quarters of it. You could only go to the bar once because the lineup was so long to get another beer, you were going to die of thirst by the time that you made it up there again. And when you did take your mess can up, it was all foam. My chum, Al Birch, and I scrounged a 5-pound lard pail. And I'd get out in line, and the first time I put it on the bar, and I told the Australian barman, I said, "Fill her up." He looked at me. But that held out for a little while. It was hot downstairs. Some of the fellows, even myself included, we took our bayonets and we cut the air conditioning units open, put up our ground sheets, used them to act like a chute to, you know, draw the air down into us. We slept over the propeller shaft. It was noisy, and every time that ship rolled or nosed, propellers would come out of the water, and that was it. They had gun practice periodically, and the paint used to drop off the ceiling when that thing fired. It was on the fantail. Matter of fact, I believe it was a field piece. I'm not quite sure, but I think it still had its wheels on, and they had it surrounded with sandbags to hold it in place. A few of us, we slept up on decks if we could get away with it. Nighttime, we'd creep up there with our hammocks and spread them out and sleep on the deck. We zigzagged. We did everything. Matter of fact, one of the chaps, I forget his name, but he received a citation for spotting an American submarine that pulled up alongside of us to refuel. He was on lookout, and I think he was more surprised than anybody else, because he was really running around there, "Submarine, submarine." On the whole, though, there was nothing, any excitement about it. We weren't torpedoed, we weren't shelled on or anything, because at that time Japan wasn't at war, and we were in the Pacific, so it's not like being in the Atlantic area.
Remember when you found out that you were going to Australia?
I believe it was around Manila somewhere that they told us. And this is where the second boat was supposed to have got it. I don't know. We never did see it following us. But this is where I believe that we were told that it was torpedoed there or captured, one of the two. We arrived in Hong Kong with quite fanfare from all the Chinese bands. They were a little disappointed. They all turned out waving flags and whatnot to see the big six-foot giants come from Canada. They got quite a surprise when they saw 5'6" and 5'7". We marched from the ship to the camp, full battle order, fixed bayonets.
Do you remember any early impressions about Hong Kong?
It stunk. That was one of the biggest impressions.
And a lot of Chinese people.
Well, what do you expect? That's about all you're going to see there. It was hot. As I say, we had fixed bayonets. We marched to the camp. We were given quarters. There was five of us NCOs that had billet to ourselves. We got a Chinese boy to shine our shoes and brass, shave us in the morning. It was pretty good. You didn't have to do it yourself. I remember the first meal that we had. Had a corporal called Jimmy Young, very deep voice chap. The British served us our meals in what they call sort of like a Dixie pot. Jim was sitting at one end of the table and I was sitting at the other, and when we proceeded to eat, the main thing was that Mr. Young was supposed to ration this out again for the rest of the men that were sitting at the table, but he decided that it was just a little enough for himself, so he takes his knife and fork, and he starts in, and he He cleaned up the works, left us all with nothing. So when the officer of the day come around, we asked him, we were going to get fed, and he said, well, what happened to the meal that was put on the table? He said, well, Jimmy had ate it. So consequently, we had to go to the NAFI then. And NAFI, this is a canteen thing, and have what they call rock cake and weak tea. And this is served by the Chinese, our Chinese stewards. Oh.
How did you get along with the English? The Canadians get along with the
There was a few fights that broke out. We were quarantined for 48 hours again, as you know that on every foreign port you have to go through a quarantine period. I got quite chummy with a Royal Scot, and a matter of fact, the first night he stuck me out. I wore a Royal Scot uniform. And I went uptown to Kowloon and went through the procedure of seeing the town. The Star Ferry was another quite an exciting thing. We used to board it, and it used to leave Kowloon Dock and take you over to the Hong Kong Islands. And when it used to dock over there, I used to run down the gangplank hollering, boy, because the rickshaws are like our taxis here, and of course they line up, and you get them excited, you end up with quite a mess. There's the shafts are between spokes, and a few of them are upset, but you don't get into one, you just keep walking, and they pace right along beside you, and they keep asking you to get in. And as you know, the first word you learn in any language is to swear, and you just tell him in a polite four-letter word to take off. We went to the Dreamland, which was a dance garden outside of Hong Kong. This is like in the suburbs. I visited the Orange Crush plant. Not that I'm an Orange Crush drinker by any means, but it was something to do. Then we started hill maneuvers to learn the terrain, and each company went in different sections of the island to learn that terrain, for the sole reason is that if anything did happen, this would be the terrain that they were going to hold, and this way they were going to familiarize themselves with the area. I was attached to headquarter company. We had Wan Chai Gap. That was our headquarter area. And then from there, we branched off different areas. As you know, headquarter company is supposed to disperse ammunition and food, so on, to the other companies that are in other areas. One company went to Canton, D Company, to look that situation over, but they were pushed back eventually when the war broke out. One incident that strikes me quite familiar, you know, it's a funny thing, but men have this nature when you're trying to train them into something realistic. They figure it's a game, and who wants to? They get tired of playing the game. So they sit down, they say, come on, I'm not climbing that hill again, you know. And this one particular time, we were on this, I just forget the name of the road, but the bombers come over, and so did the Japanese fighters. And when they dropped the bombs onto, we could overlook the bay and we could see our camp. And those big bombs started to drop, and the parade square was going up. And then this Zero came down, or this fighter, and he started to spray the road we were on. Some smart aleck said, "Boy, this war is getting, no, this maneuver is getting realistic." He said, "They're shooting real stuff at us now." And it wasn't very long after that that a runner notified us that the war was on.
So the first time you really knew was when you saw the bombs?
Mm-hmm.
Had you been expecting that?
No, not necessary. If we would have been expecting it, we wouldn't have had a huge marquee placed up in a vital headquarters area.
A marquee?
Yeah, that's a huge tent. And this is where all the ammunition was stored. And it was a real nice bright color, and it couldn't be missed from the air. But when the war started, that came down in a hurry. And another remarkable thing, the British were in charge of dishing out the ammunition. Believe it or not, I was given 50 rounds from my rifle, and this smart aleck said to me, "When you fire those 50 off, you bring the cartridges back and I'll issue you another 50. He had real sense of humor.
How about equipment? Grenadier equipment never made it.
We didn't have it, no. All that, actually, what we had was just our rifle and bayonet. This we brought with us from Canada. Some of the rifles should have been left in the 1914 war because they were really antiques. If you hit them too hard with your palm of your hand, parts of them will fall off. I eventually, one time, I got a hold of a Thompson machine gun. The British had some. We had some, I believe, one or two Bren guns, which were then also anti-tank, and a few mortars. But what good are those if you don't have the ammunition to put into them?
Well, would it have been British ammunition or the ammunition
from the boat? It was standardized.
Well, at headquarters company, did you look after the ammunition and equipment for like all the grenadiers or just certain companies?
Well, no, because, the British were there a whole lot longer than we, and they were supposed to have had dumps of ammunition. Now, they didn't do the labor. They had the Chinese do the labor. So the Chinese dug the holes, and they put the ammunition in. And then when the war broke out and they seen which side was winning, or they had an idea, they told the enemy where the dumps were. Or they blew them up so we couldn't get a hold of them. So therefore, that defeated the purpose there. The pillboxes were painted a nice whitewash color, real spit and polish job. They stood out just like sore thumbs, and they were all along the bay. They weren't cut into the banks or anything, they were right on the beach. You could poke your finger through them. The inside was made of hardboard, and the outside was, I think, 90% sand and 5% cement and the other 5% water. They had an open vent in the roof, not a zigzag effect where all you had to do was just drop a hand grenade down the vent and that landed right inside. So you were blowing smithereens out of those in a hurry. They were constantly under shell fire and mortar fire because, as I say, they were a nice target.
Between the outbreak of the war and the time the Japanese landed, did you stay in the island the whole time?
Yes.
And you were on the island when the war broke out?
We were on the island we were doing maneuvers when the war broke out. Yeah.
What kind of things happen then? Are you just trying to get men fed and holding positions?
Nighttime we were doing roadblock duty with concertina wire and barbed wire. The daytime you were using your machine gun that you had on roadblocks. You were climbing the hillsides and mounting them up there and using them for rack-ack. After you'd done the tour up there, you dismantled them, brought them down, and used them on roadblocks again. This just goes to show how few and how poor that we were established as far as fighting equipment was concerned. They were doing multi-purpose duties. They were used for everything. Sometimes at night you had to mount guard on the reservoirs. Well, of course, as soon as they did take the main reservoir over, this was the loss. They cut it and the water supply was finished.
Were you on duty almost all the time when you go on the ship?
No, you were practically on duty most of the time. When you did get a cat nap, it was 40 winks, right? There was always somebody awake to warn you if things were really getting quite hot.
Well, do you remember if you were functioning in the regiment at that time?
Were we a regiment?
Yeah, were you functioning as a regiment? Were the lines of communication such orders would be able to flow?
No, not too well. We had runners. Anybody was a runner. if you were caught, you were a runner. From, say, Wong Li Chung or to Aberdeen to there was another bay. But then the peak, which was Victoria, Wan Chai. Yeah, that's Wong Li Chung.
He's Wan Chai.
This doesn't show. This doesn't show the. Aberdeen note, does it? Aberdeen Bay.
Aberdeen Channel.
Ah, that's it, yeah. I'm looking at this backwards. This is not oriented from the other way. Because this should be north. Because this is the Victoria right in here. This is the peak. Repulse, yeah, there it is. The Quebec rifles had this part through here. We had the part over here.
I guess you've never seen any Japanese up until. Oh, what did you think about the Japanese at the time? About the war and for the Japanese, the soldiers, the reinforcements?
Well, we were told hold off another 24 hours and. Old Kai Shek on his white horse was just over the border. He was coming in full regalia, you know, but and his brass band. But he never did show up. And that white horse came down lame or something because we waited, but he didn't come. For the Japanese soldier, he's a good soldier. He can fight.
Did you know
that
at the time?
No. Well, no, we didn't, but we soon found out. He was anywhere, everywhere. They harassed you. They wouldn't let you sleep at night or catch a rest. They played on your nerves. They spoke to you all night. Some of them can speak pretty good English, too. They tormented you. They played on your mind. They made your mind play tricks on you, shadows. Especially when you're not accustomed to it. You've never seen them. Actually, you don't know what you're looking for, right? Let's face it, for a fellow from Canada here, sure, you see Orientals walking around the city of Winnipeg. But I defy the average person to tell me which is a Jap and which is a Chinaman. Even to this day, it's pretty hard for me unless I speak to them. They're a little, they all look as if they've had a kick in the face at one time when they were small. That's about the only way. Their nose is pretty flat. They really have the almond eyes. Their skin is the same color. And don't ever let them say that they're all short. There's some big ones, too. They're well-built. They're trained from a baby, from the time they're able to toddle. They're put into military schools, either the Army or the Navy itself. This is second life to them. This is what we call today their thing, right? After we did become quite acquainted with them, we can see now why they were pretty smart in outmaneuvering us and everything else. They've lost a lot of men, I would give them, but that didn't slow them down.
What kind of things happened between them after the Japanese landed on the island?
Well, I had five men in a basement of a house at Wong Li Chong. I had my buddy, Al Birch. I had a couple of chaps from out of town. I just forget their names now. But it was Christmas Day that we were informed that we had one magazine of ammunition left for the machine gun, our rifles, bayonets, a couple of hand grenades. And this was supposed to be the last stand. Word went through, when that's all used up, break the lock or take the lock out of the machine gun, dismantle it somehow. If there's some gas around, pour it, throw a grenade in it, blow the works up, then put on a bayonet and go from there. Christmas dinner, five men that was with me, we had one or two packets of hardtack, that was the hard biscuits, and a can of pork and beans, and we shared that. That was our Christmas dinner. We left the cellar we were in, and we went up to the peak. And we were told by the messenger that everybody was to meet at the peak. Oh, we were going up this road, and we turned the bend, and here's a Jap standing there with fixed bayonet. And we already knew that the island had surrendered, so the war was over. But boy, it gives you quite a sensation up your spine. You don't know whether he knows the war is over or not. But we walked by him. He didn't say anything to us. We got up pretty near to the peak, and the roadsides were lined with the Japanese army. They were sitting down. They were opening our cans of peach as our food. They were using their bayonets and knives, and they were dropping the peaches onto the ground and drinking the syrup, because they're very crazy for sugar. They love everything sweet. This made us kind of disheartened to see our food being wasted like that, especially when you didn't have any. We were mustered up there, and eventually they marched us down to the ferries, and they took us back over to the mainland, got us off the island. We were taken to the one camp, and billeted in buildings that had been bombed, and the Chinese had stripped all the windows out and all the wood that they could salvage. So consequently, you were sleeping on concrete floors. You had one blanket, bed bugs by galore, and the fleas. They opened another camp called North Point. Some were taken from the main camp because there was Punjabs, the English, the Royals, like the Middlesex, the Royal Scots, British Air Force, our own, China Command officers, and it was all one huge camp, and consequently it was too large. So they broke the camp up and made another camp. We were all interviewed. We were asked what our occupation was before we enlisted. Consequently, I, being a medical fellow before enlistment, I was sent over to the back to the island to help with the British hospital there, called the Bowen Road Hospital. Of course, you know, dysentery had broke out, and then we got a real case of diphtheria, which we lost quite a few men with dip.
What were the conditions like at the hospital? Was there any medicine?
No. Medicine was very scarce. The food was just a meager ration.
What were the doctors?
All British. They were all British doctors. The hospital itself had been bombed. The main kitchen had been bombed out. The operating room was downstairs. There was, I think, two or three wings that were intact, you know, but yes, yes.
Were there civilians or were there prisoners of war?
No, it was all soldiers.
Wounded?
Yes, definitely. Oh, yes.
I didn't ask you, were you wounded at all?
No.
And someone else wanted to ask you, how do you put the officers not reactive? How the officers performed during the battle?
During the battle? Yeah. Do I have to answer that question?
No.
I may crucify myself. I will say this. The officers we lost were the officers that were men. Close enough?
Sure. One other thing. Is there anybody who sort of stands out in your mind during the battle? Some kind of heroism?
There was one who came to us just before we left for Hong Kong. We called him Wrong Way Corrigan. Maybe you've heard of him. Well, he was an officer, a very good gentleman. Matter of fact, he wrestled a Samuri sword. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. But I bandaged his hands up once. But he grabbed the blade, and both palms of his hands were cut. He got the sword, all right. And he buried it. He wrapped it in a gas cape. He buried it. To this day, I don't know whether he went back for it or whether he got it before they took him out of there. This is one episode that stands out.
Is there much hand-to-hand fighting?
Not in my area. There was in other areas. As I say, headquarters company is, let's put it this way, more or less behind the lines, right? You're not babied at all. You, when you're delivering ammunition or that, you've got to get up there, you know. But you're not, you're actually pulled into the place to close a gap if it's required, let's put it that way, to reinforce certain areas, but not for long, because you have other duties to perform. In my own case, as I say, being at in headquarters company at Wat Chai, very little stands out from that area except for losing our trucks and no ammunition, things like this.
Were you getting enough food when you were working in the hospital?
In the hospital?
Yeah, were the patients getting any?
Well, no, they were just getting rations that were doled out from the warehouse. So many kilo of rice.
Like the same warehouse that was feeding the cats?
No, just a hospital warehouse. A truck would come in, loaded down with soya bean, you'd unload it, the rice. The odd time you would get the raw peanuts. They would roast these in the kitchen and try and make a peanut butter out of it. Well, yes and no. It was better than nothing. Garlic was a big thing. Today, you know, if somebody ever told me years ago that I'd love garlic, I'd tell them they're crazy. But the cloves of garlic, you slice them up and put them... on your rice, and boy, that really hit the spot. But everybody ate it so you couldn't smell it from another. You didn't know whether you had bad breath or not. There was a small commissary. If you had money, you could maybe purchase a little luxury. This didn't mean a lot. It was just something extra. A little bit of sugar, brown sugar or something.
How about cigarettes?
You had ways and means of getting those. You bartered for them. You did everything. You even got down on your knees towards the end and begged for them. Or you fought over them. And this bartering deal, an episode at the hospital. Well, you asked me if I was wounded during the war, right? I said, my answer was no, but I was wounded to an extent of spirit, let's put it that way. At the hospital, we did have an attempted escape. There was a fellow there, I believe he was from one of the Hong Kong volunteer divisions. He had quite a bit of jewelry, like his own personal effects. This is what you did the bartering with. This box went missing. At the same time, when the escape went on, they found the box, the jewelry and everything intact, where the barbed wire had been cut. I happened to be the orderly on duty that night, and at roll call they were covered. Consequently, when they caught the escapees, They knew that they were off my ward. So they called in their gendarmes, which you think Germany had SS troops or Gestapo. Boy, they got them too. Two of us, my chum at that time at the hospital, who was from the Quebec Rifles, we were questioned in regards to the attempt to escape, the covering up of the people that tried to escape, the jewel box going missing. I call it a jewel box. It was like one of these small bank cash box things. We were interrogated. You may laugh at this, but I had one time real bushy, wavy hair. And this was cut off by a samurai sword, by the handful. My life was threatened. We were hung up by the thumbs for 4 to 5 hours. Eventually, I was left alone. And I'm looking around, where's everybody else gone? They would leave you and let you sit for an hour or so. Then they come in and they start all over again. And so this mad Dr. Sato, he sat across the desk from me and he took the sword out of his scabbard and he said, well, he said, through his interpreter, that the interpreter was a Colonel DeMura, pretty close to my name. But this was the last chance that I had to confess. I told him that there was nothing that I could tell that I hadn't already told him. They wouldn't believe this. So they brought in the medical commanding officer, Colonel Bowie, and he talked to me for about 5 to 10 minutes. And he asked me, he said, can you take it? And I said, well, if they can't dish out any more than they've already done, yes. Why are you asking? He said, well, if you can, he said, I want you to realize that there is about 300, 400 patients in the hospital who will suffer if you don't. So by this I wanted to know what he wanted me to do. He said, well, tell him you did. And I think everything will be okay. This took a lot of nerve. I don't know. I'm no hero. But anyways, I consented. Old Dr. Sato, he again asked. So I said, yeah. Now you want to know it, so I told you. Now let me go and get some sleep. But no way. I was stripped, hung up by the thumbs. My back was lashed. They got a couple of the British soldiers that were maintenance men of the hospital. They dug a grave. They even went to the extent that they shot a Chinese. Threw him in the hole, had the two maintenance men fill the hole in. And then they told everybody in the hospital that that was me. They whisked me out of there down to the jail. Nothing in this, just a 4 small rooms. It was about 6 by 8. A little bit of straw in the corner to lay down on. I was afraid to have a bowel movement. I was afraid to even urinate. I did urinate once on my undershirt to put on my back to try and heal it. But I wouldn't let it lay around. These people now are saddest, as far as I was concerned. I used to watch the change in the guard. I was in there 3 days. One cup of water and a small bowl of rice. Yes, no glass, just barred. I could watch the changing of the guard. This particular day or particular morning, they had changed the guard. I'd watched them. I used to be able to bum the odd cigarette from a guard who was a little decent. These guards were not the Gestapo men or the gendarmes. These guards were men who had been in the front lines and had been home or are home on sort of a recuperating. These are fighters, so they know what the score is. They're not out for to watch somebody really suffer. At least that was the way I interpreted it. This particular morning, as I said, it was bright. They had changed the guard. They brought up another truck, load of soldiers, 5 in all. They lined them up facing the cell window. They loaded their rifles. Corporal came over, unlocked my door, came over with the interpreter, and ushered me out, stood me up against the wall. I asked the corporal for a cigarette. He gave it to me. He lit it. I smoked it. I didn't drag very deep on it. I wanted to make it last. As long as he stood beside me, I figured I was pretty safe. But again, it's quite a sensation. You don't know just when that number's coming. I stood there about 10 or 15 minutes. The cigarette had gone. Another truck came up. These 5 soldiers, they loaded equipment on it, their kit bags and so on. I was forced on the back of the truck and made to lay down. They put their feet on me because we were passing below the hospital. And you could look from our balcony down. I was taken to a camp and I was shipped off to Japan and with another group of men. Now these men weren't from, hadn't heard anything about what happened at Bowen Road. The only people that knew was the patients there. I arrived in Japan. We went to Oyama prison, or POW camp. And we started all over again. We got our numbers. My number is Nihako Nano Junana, which is 277. We were given huts. First night we had to count or learn to count in Japanese. On the wall they had it on English, and the word for one they had it in, wrote in Japanese. The interpreter showed us how to pronounce the vowels. It's a fairly simple language. But they only had from 1 to 10. We had 45 men in the hut. The camp commandant, the pig, he come around eventually and he told us that we had to be able to count before we'd have supper or a meal. The interpreter lined us up and We had to write dress in Japanese commands. We didn't know what it was, but anyways, he hollered out bango. Well, it sounds like bingo, but it was bango, and that means you got a number from the right. Well, the first 10 men were lucky because they could read the board. But the poor 11th man, he didn't know where he went because there was no 11. And we weren't instructed that you take the 10 and add the 1 and make it into 11, which you call, you go ichi ni ju san shi go raku shi yachi ku ju. You see, ju is 10. You can go ju ichi ju ni ju san ju shi ju raku. And all the way through to you hit 20. And then you take the 2, the 10, and the 1, and you get 21. This is quite a sing-song. Then you learn to talk. You're spoken into Japanese. Some of the Polish, if they had been brought up in the States and they went back to Japan, they frowned on you if you did answer in Japanese, or Nipponese is their term. And then again, if you didn't know which way to take them, if you answered them in English, you were beat again. Just any excuse to punish you. Yes. Believe it or not, we moved a whole mountain and threw it into the bay there. It's open-faced mining. Three cuts, three levels. Did some mining. I became the jackhammer man, drilled the holes, dynamited, planted, and had them charged off. Then sickness hit us bad. Dysentery again. Then the men were getting weak, nothing to eat. The men who were able to go out to work, they had to work an extra amount to feed the men that were in hospital. The men in hospital only got half a ration. So it was up to the man who could slug it out to work hard enough for the person that was in hospital. The one main hospital, which was run by a British sergeant major and a British doctor, they were the Gestapo of the camp. Not so much the doctor, but the sergeant major was. We also had one of our own sergeant majors who got himself involved in this. He thought the other side of the fence looked greener too. But that hospital became overcrowded, so we opened another hut, a hospital hut. They built it actually. And I was placed in charge of that one. Few of the men didn't like what I had to do, but I think today they realize that it saved their bacon in regards to some men had foot rot. They lost their toes being in water all the time. One person in particular, he has no toes. We have no freezing, very few instruments, but I removed them as painlessly as I could. No. Well, there was other things that had to be done, and you had to do it. Person's stomachs, they used to swell beyond the limit of an extension.
Was this beriberi?
Beriberi, yeah.
Maybe you can tell me how some of these retrieved or could you treat
them? You couldn't treat too much. The main and the best system that we had was to pierce a needle into the abdominal wall. A hollow needle, that is, a hypodermic needle, and drain it into anything that you had, a wash basin, all fluid, and it just, I don't know whether you've ever seen glucose. It's a It's a syrupy content used in hospitals for mixing with drinks. It's low in calorie, but it's very sweet. This is what it looks like. It's a thick amber color, constituency of like honey. It's not thin like water. It doesn't just spurt out. It will ooze. Other times you had to use your scalpel and make small incisions to drain the surface fluid, which was between the tissue and the, no use me going into medical terms for you, but it's between the layer of fat and the outer skin, and this also becomes abundant with fluid. So you just make a small incision. There is no blood. This fluid just oozes out.
Why did the fluid pile up? Did the kidneys stop?
Beriberi is a... I don't think the doctors today know actually what caused it. Sure, it's a lack of the nutrients and vitamins and so on. And that's why they gave it the name of vitaminosis. But there is no actual thing that you can do to actually correct it, except give them vitamin B, C, and D. The body has used it. Just take for yourself. If you go on a fast, say for 14 days, sure, your body you just won't wilt and die. It'll live off the tissues. It'll even use the marrow out of your bones or the cartilage between the spinal columns. That's why some of the men who went overseas, especially Hong Kong, where food was so scarce, a man went over there and he was 6'1". He comes back, he's 5'11". And people won't believe it. Why? You don't shrink. Sure you shrink. That cartilage is gone. It's not all gone. It's just thinned down. Happy feet. Well, this works two ways. Hot and cold. Some you can't... put a sheet or even a tissue paper on it. You can hold the back of your hand, which is more tender to heat than the palm, even though you say you touch a stove with your finger and kapow, but you put the back of your hand. Hold it about. You have to tell the patient, though, that you're not going to touch his feet because he'll go berserk. But you can hold your hand about 1.5 inches, two inches away from the sole of his feet. And you can feel the heat just burning. Another one, the feet are ice cold, which are the way mine are. You can put them in boiling hot water. Put them in a pail of water, light a fire, and sit there. Matter of fact, one fellow in North Point Camp did this. He had a 5-gallon gasoline can. His feet were so cold. And he cooked them. Cooked both feet. You could take a knife and have steak off of you on it. But you're actually losing the sense.
Did you go from hot to cold, or
No, one or the other. At least as far as I know. Don't quote me as far as the.
But your feet went cold.
My feet went cold. As a matter of fact, they're. They're always cold, and I don't know why, but in the winter time, this is why maybe I don't feel them. I don't wear overshoes. I don't wear underwear. I wear the same type of sock all year round. I tramp the streets on a salesman, or at least I was. That is very, very.
Is it numb? It's like
well, asleep? It is,
yeah,
yes.
That's about the only way I can describe
yeah. But, there. Never changes.
Was it the circulation or the nerve?
This they won't tell you. You want to feel my legs, they're cold.
They are cold, yeah. Is there any feeling at all?
Oh, yeah, you have feeling. But this is the way it acts. If you take your shoes off, now, like mine are encased, as soon as I go home, I must remove my shoes. And then they just fold out, and then, say, I have to go out again. As a matter of fact, coming here tonight, I worked all day at home. I had quite a time to get the shoes back on, because you can see I don't have them pulled tight. But this seems to be a natural thing. Same with the palms or your fingers. They will go numb. First like as if they've gone to sleep, pins and needles. You've heard of this expression.
Mm-hmm.
But then they'll go so numb that you can swear that you can break that finger off. Or cut it off with a knife and never feel no pain. It's just as if you've had a shot of Novocaine or some freezing injection. This affects practically where you have the sense of feeling. We've had sore tongues in the camp, what they call like strawberry. Another great one was where your
sore tongue.
Yeah, it's a burning sensation on the tip of your tongue. It's just like as if you drank too hot a cup of tea or too hot a cup of coffee. But it's there continuous. Whatever you put in your mouth, it burns it, it aggravates it. And this really makes your eyes water. It's painful. Your genital organs, your scrotum gets very inflamed and festered, and it's just like as if you've got a real bad case of scabies, which you haven't. It's just that it's got to break out somewhere. Pellagra sores, running ulcers, these are things that all come from lack of
vitamins. I think there'd be pretty well a whole range of all these things.
Every man had them. I don't think any man that. Let's put it this way, I don't know nothing what happened in a European theater. I've never visited one of their camps. These things, they happen only in the theaters that I was in. So I don't actually know whether they suffered the same handicaps or went through the same...
How did the Japanese people or the guards, did they ever suffer
anything? No, not that was noticeable to us.
They were getting more food.
Well, when anything came into the camp, they got the choices cut, you know. They brought in a poi poi or a bit of whale or horse meat. Most of that went home or over to their own kitchen, and they had it. We were left the bones, and they were throwing at us just like watching a dog fight over a bone. They took great enjoyment watching this kind of thing. Let's put it this way, as I said before, they're good fighters, but they're very childish too. Anything will amuse them. And if they can make you suffer or squirm, this amuses them more. So what you had to do was not mimic them, but go along with them. And once they saw that you went along with them, they'd leave you alone. If you were wanted trouble, it was easily found. I'm not going to say to collaborate with them, but don't go out of your way. As I always figure, never mind, look after today and tomorrow following, something like that. So that's about...
How How about the end of the war? Were you able to tell what the end is?
I had an inkling, because as I said, I wasn't running the Canadian part of the hospital. At 12 o'clock at night, I used to have to go for my midnight meal. I was cutting across the big, huge compound to go to the galley. And this was at 12 o'clock. I wasn't challenged. Prior to that, every night when I used to go, some sentry would challenge me. And I would have to converse with him and tell him that you'd be ASAE, meaning number one medical. And this particular night, I saw a couple of the sentries pulling down the Japanese signs. They had no rifles, no bayonets. It seemed kind of strange. I could walk anywhere. I went to the galley and I spoke to one of the British Air Force fellows who was cooking on duty that night, and I told him there was something queer going on in the camp. So I said, come on inside, Wilson, and have a look. Well, he was always in trouble, this chap, and he wasn't going to go outside. I said, come on, there's nothing to be alarmed at. So he did, and he advised me to go over and wake up the sergeant major of the camp. So I went over to the hut and I woke the sergeant major up and explained to him what was going on. He got dressed, came out. We walked all over the camp, anywhere and anywhere. And nobody said anything to us. So he said, well, I'll find out in the morning. So sure enough, at roll call, he addressed us all in English before it was all in Japanese. He had us line up, right dress, from the night, right number. And some of us had forgot English. It was quite funny to hear some of them say about four or five numbers in Japanese, and then somebody would say three and four in English, and then they go back to Jap again, you know. But we went through the whole count. We weren't corrected. The pig stood up on the rostrum and didn't say anything. And eventually he just took into his own hands. And he just told the pig to get down, I'm taking over. He did. He detailed a squadron to go to the guardhouse and take command of that. We took the rifles and bayonets. I shouldn't say we, but the men in the camp did. Then, a little later on in the morning, an American plane came over and dropped a canister with a couple of pennants on it and informed us that it was over and to keep us off the parade square when they were going to drop some grub. That was it. But otherwise, that's about the whole thing.
I don't want to go on. We talked a lot. There's only one other thing I'd like to know. Is what the war times you mentioned earlier?
Well, we held those at Fort Osborne Barracks. Sadly to say, the outcome wasn't what we anticipated.
This was the Canadian?
Yes. And the British. We had them here, too. And I believe what really happened is that they got them all out of Canada and got them out of here in a hurry because there wasn't too much.
You kept calling the commandant pig. Is that what everybody else called?
That's the Japanese word for it, yeah, the pig. Yeah. He's a big fat slob, so you call him the pig, didn't you?
What happened to him? You know?
The bad ones of the camp, they took them all out that night by truck. The same as with the...
The Americans took them out?
No, the Japs took them out themselves. The same with the British Sergeant Major and our own Sergeant Major and a couple of the other fellows that were in cahoots, and they whisked them away. But the Canadian Sergeant Major, he was caught up with at Guam, and he was taken into custody by the American provost.
What about the British regiment?
I don't know where he ever went.
Do you remember his name?
Oh, yes. Sergeant Major Harvey. Never forget him. He loved to stand you to attention and beat you. But as I say, he was really on their side.
I don't think there's any answer, but maybe just quickly tell me how you came back to England.
While I flew from Tokyo, well, they took us from our camp. I think we were in the camp about 26 days before they liberated us out of there.
They dropped good food?
Yes. Matter of fact, I only lived on Hershey bars. Your stomach couldn't absorb it. Let's put it that way. It was too much in such a short time for the system to get accustomed to. Who can eat a gallon of peaches?
Or
yes, but sicker than a dog. The stomach just won't hold it. I found the Hershey bar and was that's that solid, real inch square bar, and you try and bite that. No, we loaded up the food that we had left. We loaded that up in boxcars, took us with us. We went to Tokyo. They took us in an LSD craft out to the bay and put us on a battle wagon and disinfected us, showered us, gave us clean clothes. We were out in the battle wagon about a week or so, brought us back into Tokyo airport. We flew from Tokyo to Guam. As I said, we got lost in Guam. They forgot all about us. That was like the attachment I was with. Then they put us on some of the fellows flew home, but in our case we came by boat on an American troop ship. It was a Marine. We were supposed to land at San Diego, about 200 miles out. They changed course and took us down to, or San Francisco, I keep getting that confused there. San Francisco, and then about 200 miles they changed course and took us down to San Diego. We were put in a camp there, and a liaison officer from Canada was down here with a couple of women and our battle dress. This is the first time that we were wearing American clothing. We got into our own, and as I say, they decorated us out like Christmas trees. We had more patches, service stripes, moon stripes, and every other kind of stripe. We made our way up the coast by train to Seattle. And from Seattle, we went over to Victoria, to the hospital there. And then we stayed in the hospital there for a while.
And made it well.
Oh, yes. The only thing that was... about the treatment?
Yeah,
they're slow.
Well...
You know, everybody is, you know, the government has one speed, right? And no way are you going to rush them. The only thing is that, let's face it, if they went any much longer, there's not going to be many of us left. We're not young chickens. I guess the average Hong Kong fella right now is about 67, 68. Some are older. And what's our lifespan nowadays?
Yeah.
Not too much. One other little incident. I meant to tell you, when we were at Tokyo in the airfield, as you know, everybody was looking for souvenirs of some description. And some had carbines, hands, swords, bayonets, whatever they could get a hold of. I was scouting around there, and I went over to the hangar, and there was a machine gun, a hydraulic machine gun off a Zero fighter, and I confiscated that. Mechanics didn't like it, but I was sort of now in the position that I could have it. Packed it in grease, wrapped it in Japanese paper, and I put it in a kit bag. I lugged that thing from Tokyo on the plane to Guam. I nursed it in Guam. I got it on the ship right to San Diego. I got it all the way up the coastline to Seattle, and we were on the dock, and the customs man was checking us over, and he was looking us up and down, and he was looking at all the different souvenirs, you know. And he said to me, he said, don't you have a souvenir? And I said, sure, I got a souvenir. And he said, what is it? I said, I got a machine gun. I had one belt of ammunition. And he said, well, where is it? And I said, in this kit bag. It weighed approximately, oh, I just forget how much, but it close to maybe 125 pounds. It killed me to carry it. Dragged it most of the time. But anyways, he wouldn't believe me. And then he said, well, dump it out and let's have a look. So I did. That was the end of it. Couldn't take it out of the States. It's a war weapon. So he said, I'm sorry. And no way could I get it. So it stayed right on the dock. At least they confiscated it. It was no good to anybody. It had to be hydraulic fired anyways. It would have looked nice over a fireplace or something. But that was just one little episode that had some excitement in it, lugging that thing all the way. But I think that's about all there is.
How do you feel with Mars?
Very good. I have a few Japanese friends. We converse. They don't like to talk to if like out amongst yourselves. And, let's face it, I've forgotten an awful lot too.
I expect a lot of it was more of individuals.
Yeah. You didn't carry on a full conversation of your life history in Japanese. It's short sentences and just like, you know, good morning, good evening, good night, see you again, or how are you, what kind of day it is or the time or something like this, you know. It wasn't a family history topic or anything.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.